I was requested to speak on a specific topic. It is. I don't have to look at my cue sheet because I know what it is. The topic is the role of faith and how to strengthen faith, and specifically through the process of hearing and chanting, how is it that by Shravanam Kirtan, Vishnu, hearing about transcendental topics, that one's faith becomes stronger. So to do this, to address the topic, we have some special sound effects here. There are two verses that I'm going to be speaking about, or from. So Bhagavad Gita chapter 9, text 3, Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, text 7, and this is our Bhagavad Gita here. Just before coming here, I was in Nashville, Tennessee, and Abhishek Singh was driving me to the airport, and he was describing, he's in a graduate course, some kind of business-related graduate course at, I think it's Vanderbilt, I'm not sure. And one of his fellow students is an American, and he happened to notice that his American friend was reading a translation of Bhagavad Gita that he had never seen before, and his friend on his cell phone had a picture of Krishna. And so he said to his friend, "Excuse my roaming eyes, but I couldn't help but notice that you're reading this Bhagavad Gita and you have a picture of Krishna on your cell phone." He said, basically, "What's up?" And his friend said, "I've been searching for the past 10 years for something that I can really place my faith in. And of all the things that I've found that resonates the most, it's Bhagavad Gita." He said, "Really, tell me a little bit more." So he, you know, had spent time at a Zen center in Nashville, Tennessee, and had learned that there's multiple forms of Buddhism, had read the Quran, had again read the Bible, had read the Sufi literature, and so forth and so on, and amongst all those things that he had read, Bhagavad Gita, his friend, or his classmate, spoke of it. He said there are many things that are in scriptures that generally resonate, but there are lots of superfluous stuff. But in Bhagavad Gita, there's nothing superfluous. It's all right on the mark. So I like that. And then he said, "You know, can I take a look at the translation? Does it have word for word?" He said, "No, but it has a little summary at the beginning of each chapter." He said, "I know a Bhagavad Gita that has the original Sanskrit, Devanagari, and then the word for word." And he said, "Oh, if you can get one of those for me, I'd really like that." Then it has an explanation of each of the verses. He said, "Oh, I'd really like that too." So he's just exploring. And even amongst what he's exploring, the translation that's most likely scholarly, but not devotional, is inspiring his faith. So in Bhagavad Gita, there are a few places specifically where Krishna speaks about the importance of faith and what faith is. I think that's a good place to start. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gives a very, very succinct, very simple definition of faith. And I'll say it in Bengali and then give the meaning. Shraddha, that's the Sanskrit word for faith. Shraddha shabde. Visvash kahe. Sudridha nishchaya. Krishne bhakti. Sarva karma kritahoya. That the verse says. Faith means, when one says faith, it means trust, unflinching trust, that by achieving one thing, all other desirable things will be accomplished. So if I place my faith in this one thing, there may be other things that I desire in life or from life, but if I do this one thing, all other desirable things will flow from it. And then the second part says, that is Krishna bhakti, Krishne bhakti, devotion unto Krishna. Sarva karma kritahoya, sarva karma, all activities kritahoya, they're accomplished. Prabhupada makes it really easy for us to understand. What that means is, if you have $1 million, you can take care of your $10, $100 problems. That's really easy to understand. So what's the $1 million solution? What's the one thing? If you have that one thing, all the other things are accomplished. And according to Bhagavad Gita, those of you that are familiar with Bhagavad Gita, you know 241 Bhagavad Gita, Vyavasayatmika buddhi ekeha kura nandana. Eka means one. The intelligence of those who are on this path, their aim is one. That's because they have faith. If I can achieve this one thing, all the things. So I just focus on this one thing. It should be simple. It's not simple because we're not simple. We're very complicated. I learned this from a devotee who was taking a business course, a finance course at Brown University. They taught hedging. He'd explained he stopped because he didn't like it. Hedging in finance means you don't put everything in one, you some of here and some of there and some of there, so if something goes down, you don't lose everything. You do some of this and some of that and some of that. So there's in gambling, it's hedging your bets. You don't put all your eggs in one basket, some of this and some of that. So some persons can't place their faith exclusively in one thing. They're trained. Don't do that. Do a little, spread it around. So the definition given in Bhagavad Gita is those who, on the path of spiritual elevation, they place their faith in one thing. Their intelligence direct them is given to them, the dhammi buddhi yogantam, Krishna from within, gives them the intelligence, yena mamupiyantite, how to get to him. And then, in that Bhagavad Gita 241, Krishna says, for those that don't, bahu shakha, bahu means many, and shakha means branched. Their intelligence is, using our American vernacular, splayed out. They can't focus. They have to think of too many things. Okay, I'm planning my vacation. I'm going to go here and do this and buy one of those and travel this way and stay at this place and do this and that. And by the end of the vacation, your head's spinning because it didn't work the way that you had planned it, and the happiness isn't there, and then you go back to work. Bahusha ka hinantasya vyavaso buddhayo vyavasainam. And it's how, not just vacations, it's how life is lived. by those that don't have faith in the supreme destination of life, or the behind the facade. Faith is preliminary faith, adau shraddha. This is another place where this is discussed by Rupa Goswami. A preliminary faith is beyond the facade of all things of this world. Take away the veneer, and behind the veneer there's another dimension. I don't know exactly what that other dimension is. There's another reality. It's a higher reality that is where real happiness is. It's where I really belong. I don't know exactly what it is, but I know that it is. I know that it exists. And I wish to achieve that. That's preliminary faith. And then in Rupa Goswami's teachings, the next thing that happens, when God, who's situated within one's heart, sees that preliminary faith, he sends some representative. He sends to that individual soul an opportunity to nurture that faith, or the little spark to fan the spark, so the spark becomes a little flame. That's representative of the Supreme. That's, in Sanskrit, is sadhu, or a saintly person, one who is situated in sat. Sat means eternality, or spirituality, or that which is existing beyond time and space, that which is existing beyond circumstances that are coming into being and going out of being. They're in touch with, they have shelter of that eternal spiritual reality. Those persons are sent by the Supreme to give association to one who has this preliminary faith. So, preliminary faith is within the soul already. All souls. More than preliminary faith, that's in the dormant stage, but in the mature stage, love of God is there. Just like within a seed is the potency or the potential of whatever that is the seed of, a tree or a plant or something, everything that you need to have a, Prabhupada uses the example of a banyan tree because they're so big. I visited the Hawaii temple in December past year, and in their backyard is this huge banyan tree. They've had some people, botanists, come and you know, estimate how old it is, and I forget, you know, so many hundreds of years old, 500, 600, so many hundreds of years old. It's huge. The circumference of the main, and then there's all these other ones that come down, and it's huge. But in each, and there's a pod in the banyan tree, and each of the pods there's many banyan seeds, and each of the banyan seeds has a banyan tree that can make one of those. So there's hundreds of thousands of banyan trees hanging from the branches in the form of seeds. And within that seed, a banyan tree that produces so many seeds that produces so many banyan trees. So the seed is the preliminary, and then through the germinating process, in terms of faith, the germinating process is association. So those that have even preliminary faith and they hear the message of Bhagavad Gita, then that's an eligibility. In Sanskrit, the word is adhikar. It gives one qualification to understand reality with a capital R. And those that don't have it don't have that eligibility. It's like a password. You can't get in without the password. There's all this wonderful reality, but you can't access it. So this is chapter 9. I'm going to do a little... Hopefully I'll do a little. beginning presentation of Chapter 9, Bhagavad Gita, because Krishna, in Chapter 9, speaks of those that have faith and those that don't have faith. Chapter 9 of Bhagavad Gita is called The Most Confidential Knowledge. That's the translation in English. And the verse, just the introductory, the proclamation of the glories of the chapter at the beginning. Krishna describes that this is the most confidential knowledge of anything that I presented so far. Most confidential knowledge. Where do we go? Presentations.
Chapter 9, the most confidential knowledge.
What happened? Want to increase the volume? There's supposed to be some background music playing. There we go. You put it on top, because, yeah. Very peaceful, isn't it? So, the most confidential knowledge has to do with the relationship of the individual soul with the Supreme. Confidential knowledge is that apart from this body, the self is a spiritual particle that animates the body, a soul. And there are two different categories, matter and spirit. And we are in the category of spirit, although we're largely commonly identifying with matter. It's not our identity. Spirit is our identity. That's confidential knowledge. And it's so confidential that you can tell people and they'll go, yeah, right, and still not get it. It's that kind of confidential. More confidential is to understand that within the heart of every living being, not only there's a soul that's animating the body, but there's a form of the Supreme Soul also within the heart of every living entity. Like in the Upanishads, it speaks of two birds within a tree. So the metaphor is the body is the tree. One of the birds is jumping from branch to branch trying to enjoy the fruits of the tree. That's us, trying to enjoy fruitive activity and the fruits of those fruitive activities. And there's a second bird, that's Krishna, is situated in the same tree, this body, and he's observing. He's the witness bird. Upadrashta. He's observing. And Anumanta. He's permitting. He's the sanctioning supreme. Like the Bible teaches, the kingdom of God is within you. So it's even very specifically described. Within this body, the individual soul and the supreme soul. The supreme soul is fully conscious, not only of this body, but of all bodies and all minds, and it's information overload for any of us even to consider. But he is supremely conscious. And hit the volume down a little bit. He's supremely conscious, and we have a relationship with him. That's the most confidential knowledge. So Krishna begins the introductory Mahima section. That this is the most confidential knowledge of anything that I presented so far in Bhagavad Gita. And then he says that those that are not faithful cannot understand it. So, I guess it separates the men from the boys. The faithful from the not faithful. You know, whether one will understand it or not understand it. And even if there's some preliminary faith, just going back to this graduate student in Knoxville, no, Nashville, he doesn't know what the absolute truth with capital A and capital T is, but he has some faith that it exists. And he's searching for it. So that preliminary faith combined with the most confidential knowledge, it's the transmitter and the receiver are both on, then something's going to be experienced by that person. That's what Krishna is saying. So now I'm going to go to this introductory section. Hopefully.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Arjuna, because you are never envious of me, I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge and realization, knowing which you shall be relieved of the miseries of material existence. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, and it is joyfully performed."
Then Krishna speaks of the position of those that hear these glories but don't understand them.
"Those who are not faithful in this devotional service cannot attain me, O conqueror of enemies. Therefore they return to the path of birth and death in this material world."
And there's a consequence, besides they don't understand, that lack of faith places one in the samsara, the cycle of birth and death, the wheel of birth and death in material existence. So we'll go over here where one could ask the question, if it's so easy, so joyful and so sublime, why isn't everybody engaged in devotional service? And the answer is because they don't have faith. And there are different categories of why people don't have faith. Some people just don't know what the scriptures say. Some people know what the scriptures say, but they don't believe it. And some people have some belief, but they're hesitating. They're internally, there's some doubt. And Krishna speaks again and again in Bhagavad Gita and other scriptures of the world, but some persons just have a hard time accepting the position of devotion to the Supreme. They think it's sentiment, blind sentiment, some phrase, some eulogy, something for the sentimental people that don't have the intellectual acumen to get it together to be strong and just be spiritual on their own strength. Some people are just not interested. They have worldly pleasures they're looking for, and this doesn't attract them. The example, well, it doesn't. In the Bhagavatam, there's an example of like a frog in a well can't understand the vastness of the ocean. So Prabhupada has reduced it to Dr. Frog, the scientist that has his measuring sticks in his hand. And when someone informs Dr. Frog, the scientist, that there is a place where there's so much more water than the water that's in your well, my dear Dr. Frog. And Dr. Frog is in disbelief. Well, how much water is there? Is it twice as big as my well? Three times as big as my well? No, it's much bigger. 10 times as big as my well. No, much, much. 10 times. 100 times. No, much bigger. No. This is such a big well. I've measured it many times. So, by empiric standards, that which is within our sense inspection, we can't imagine potencies or existences far beyond our experience that we can't measure. And when it speaks of such things, then the faithless person rejects it. So here's this definition given by Chaitanya Charitamrita, that unflinching trust in something sublime, tarora mulam, yata taror mula nishenchanena, from the Bhagavatam, just like pouring water on the root of a tree nourishes all the branches and twigs and leaves and fruits and flowers and all the parts of the tree, similarly, by finding the root of all existence and placing one's full energy and ability and everything upon the root of all existence, the whole of existence flourishes. Everything that we require, everything we may desire, is best accomplished that way. That's faith. So, for spiritual progress, faith is very, very important for spiritual development. And it's practical. It's not just something you feel, a little palpitation of the heart, and you feel good. There may be some feelings, certainly there's feelings involved, but it's practical. Practical application of activity. And when there's faith, there's not reluctance or distraction, but practical activity in service to the Supreme. So there's a whole chapter in Bhagavad Gita on faith where Arjuna wants to know, if people don't have faith in you, Krishna, will they have faith in something else? And the answer is yes, they'll have faith in something, because faith is intrinsic to the soul. The soul has a natural relationship with God, there will be faith. And if it's not faith in God, it's going to be faith in something. So, devotional faith, or faith in God, is created through association. This is King Prachinibari, this is Narada Muni, a great sage, and by the sage giving association to the king's natural inclination for faith grew and became very strong. And that in that association there is hearing. So I said at the very beginning, there is an important role that hearing has in awakening faith. It's through association. But in association, this is Shukadeva Goswami, this is Maharaj Parikshit, and by hearing, the king, hearing from the great sage Shukadeva, he achieved spiritual perfection. And this painting, maybe you can't see so well because the contrast isn't so good, but here's Srila Prabhupada speaking before an assembly of his Western audience, and he's portraying the picture of Krishna's message of Bhagavad Gita spoken to Arjuna. And by that process of hearing, then those of us who grew up in the West and never heard of Krishna before had our instinctual, natural, dormant spiritual faith aroused just by the process of hearing. And along with associating and hearing comes serving. And when one serves as this king, Prataparudra, served Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he also, through that association, received enormous spiritual benefit. Now, the person's... Oh, you're sending them out of the room.
I should probably come here.
You just stay in the room. Don't leave the room. I'm going to end this very shortly, and then everybody can scoot around and be comfortable. I was thinking. I'm just going to skip the next section. The next section is the story of Narada Muni. This is particularly for our American guests sitting over there, and you don't know who Narada Muni or what any of this stuff is. But they're nice pictures. So I'm going to show you those nice pictures and narrate the story, especially people sitting in the front can sit down so they can see. And then I'll turn off this projector and we'll get normal again. But what I'm going to narrate now is the story of a young boy who achieves spiritual perfection from a position of being a nobody. And his name in this lifetime is Narada Muni, but in the previous lifetime, and actually a different age altogether, is this little boy here, in his previous birth. And he was the son of a maidservant, and there's no mention of his father. Father was deceased, or who knows what happened. Just the mother and the boy. And in India, there's a four-month rainy season. During that rainy season, sages like these gentlemen, they would stay in one place, not travel, and then after the rainy season, resume their travel. And they stayed at this inn, or Dharamshala, or this residential place, and the little boy was given the assignment of assisting them. He brought their meals, as you see. He would, little errands, whatever little boy can do. Wash their clothes, take care of whatever little thing he could do. And in the course of that being with these saintly persons, he would hear their discussions. And gradually the saintly persons developed some affection, because although he was a little boy, he wasn't like some little boys are that I know, very playful, running around, you know, yada yada yada. He was very calm, very peaceful, and he appreciated the message of the sages, and so they showered their blessings upon him in different ways. They gave the remnants of their food, which was blessed by their having offered it to Krishna. And taking the remnants of their food, he felt purified. And he's a little boy, but this is just in a short period of 4 months. Gradually, they taught him spiritual practices and spiritual lessons. And gradually, his taste for spiritual, eternal life grew. And he then had some realizations that his real identity was this spiritual existence, spiritual spark, spiritual force within. That was who he really was, not just the gross or subtle coverings, and that he had a relationship with God just through this association. And gradually that continued to grow in his realization of God's nature, his existence, his relationship with him. And he became increased, and Narada in his previous life had a desire to meet him and be with him and serve him. Little boy. He just accepted with faith the messages that he heard from these sages. So after the 4 months of the rainy season were over, he was left alone with just his mother. And then as fate would have it, one evening when his mother went to get water from the well, she was bitten in the leg by a serpent and instantly died. So here's this little boy with no father and now with no mother. And he didn't start crying and weeping. He somehow, because of his faith, accepted somehow this is a plan of God, and I now have an opportunity to leave the situation and search for God. And so he, that very day, he packed his little backpack and off he went. left his cell phone behind. And he went through all varieties of experience. Sarvakatam, this is experiencing all varieties of life. Cities, towns, villages, forests, everything. And each evening, morning and evening, he would sit and perform that discipline that the sages had taught him. So one fine morning, early in the morning, he sat down to meditate on the form of the Supersoul within his heart, and suddenly that form of the Supersoul within his heart appeared. And he was in ecstasy. Tears were rolling down his eyes, and his whole body was trembling, and he felt transcendental emotion, seeing the Lord of his life. And then suddenly that form of the Lord disappeared, and he was more startled. And he looked around, where is he gone? And he heard the Lord's voice saying, for the rest of your life you will not see me again, but continue the practices that you're doing. I've shown my special mercy to you. Continue like this and you'll achieve spiritual perfection. So he did. And at the end of his life, when the soul left the body, the soul immediately achieved a spiritual form. It said in a very nice way, as lightning and illumination occur simultaneously, so similarly his spiritual form was manifested when his body was finished. And that body, the spiritual body, was all spiritual. He then describes to his disciple, Vyasadeva, that he entered into the body of the Supreme Personality of Godhead for one night of Lord Brahma, and in the next morning of Lord Brahma, he manifested as a son of Lord Brahma, as Narada Muni, and he began traveling all over the universe, spiritual and material creation, serving the Supreme Lord, carrying the Lord's glories. So this is one historical example of how association can and does awaken the dormant faith that all living beings have within themselves. And now we're going to shut this off. We can go ahead. Shut this off. So we can get normal again. We can move around. People that are up in the balcony can come around and be normal. It'll shut down by itself. So all of that was to expand a little bit up on this one verse, 9.3 Bhagavad Gita. Yeah. Where Krishna is describing the necessity of faith. With faith, one can enter into the mystery of transcendence, without which one cannot, and the consequence, not only one cannot enter into the mystery of transcendence, but then one stays within the cycle of birth and death. Because one of the messages, overall messages of Bhagavad Gita that Krishna is presenting is this is an unnatural place for us. We are, by constitution, spirit soul, and we're in the material atmosphere, and it's unnatural. It's like a person in a diseased condition. Just to use the metaphorical example, our temperature is, normal temperature is 98.6 Fahrenheit. So one might have a temperature of 100, and you're feeling uncomfortable, because it's not normal. And the solution to the not normal isn't to make the temperature 101 or 102. Increase the fever. That's not the solution. The solution is also not make your temperature zero. The solution is make your temperature 98.6. So what's the normal condition of who we really are? First, we need to know who we really are. And so in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna introduces to Arjuna, and thereby to us, who we really are. And who we really are is chapter 2. And in chapter 2, he makes that confidential knowledge presentation to Arjuna, where he says, our real identity is, we're an eternal fragmental part of the Supreme. Well, later that's described. But at least we're distinct from matter. Trying to think of a verse where Krishna speaks that we're jiva bhuta sanatana. Mami vamsa jiva loke. Jiva bhuta sanatana. Sanatana means eternal. Jiva is a term that means the soul, and the soul is an angsa, a very tiny part. An example is a particle of gold compared to a gold mine, or a drop of water compared to the ocean, or a particle of sunlight compared to the sun. Qualitatively, like the whole, quantitatively, very tiny. That's the soul in relation to the Supreme. But first, one needs to understand the soul is distinct from matter. That's chapter 2, Bhagavad Gita. And so this other verse that I was asked to speak about is where Arjuna submits himself to Krishna. Yeah. Karpanya dosha pahata swabhava. Karpanya dosha means out of miserly weakness. Miserly weakness. The soul has natural strength, just like light is stronger than darkness. I'll put it as a question. Which is stronger? Ramchandra. Which is stronger, light or darkness? Which is stronger, light or darkness?
Light.
Okay. How do you know?
Guess.
You guessed. 50-50. Well, let me ask you a question in between your drum beats. Supposing you wake up in the middle of the night and it's dark and you want to see what's going on in your room. So what do? Turn on the light. What happens? The darkness is dispelled because you turned on the light, right?
Yeah.
So there's an there's an example of light dispels darkness. Light is stronger than darkness. He likes playing drum. His knee is a portable drum. He practices so many hours a day. So, the soul has its natural strength. But there's the natural strength of the soul becomes weakened, karpanya dosha, by miserliness. So Prabhupada describes what miserliness is. There's a brahmana and there's a kripana. The brahmana is very liberal and the kripana is very miserly. The Brahmana is one who is in touch with knowledge of spirit, and they very liberally live their life accordingly. That is, they don't live their life with attachment to matter, they live their life with attachment to spirit, and therefore they're very broad-minded about how they value life in general. They value not just their life, or their family, or their group, or their nation, or their tribe, or their whatever. They value life in general, because there's life within the tree, and there's life within the squirrel, and there's life within all forms of life. It's because of the spiritual identity, tattvadarshi, in the language of Bhagavad Gita. Pandita samadarshana, vidyavanaya sampane, brahmani gavi hastani, shuni chaiva sopaki cha. Pandita samadarshana, pandit, a learned person, sees with equal vision. The soul that's within all the differences of forms of life, there's a spiritual spark. They can see, and therefore they're broad-minded towards those of different species or different differences, even the same species, but they manifest differences. And having some discussions on the topic of unity in diversity, something that Prabhupada has spoken about, that's a very deep subject. Anyway, there's diversity of forms of life, but a brahmana, they can see the distinctions of forms of life, but they see the unity within, and therefore they're very open and very respectful and very courteous and kind and all nice things towards all varieties of living beings because of that spiritual perspective. And then there's another category where the illumination of the soul is covered by miserliness or by material conception. And the miserly is, you know, I'm interested in me and mine. And beyond me and mine, I'm not very liberal. In fact, there's competition and enmity and envy and discord. And then there's a whole bunch of other people all over the place that have similar karpanya dosha, miserly weakness, and they're at odds with each other. So Arjuna is speaking of himself honestly, that the illumination capacity to see properly, see things in a proper way, has been taken away. It's been covered by his miserly weakness, by a material conception of life. So, see, he says, I'm confused about my duty and have lost all composure because of miserly weakness. In this condition, I am asking you to tell me for certain what is best for me. Now I am your disciple and a soul surrendered unto you. Please instruct me. Shishyaste ham sharimam tvam prapanam. The last line of the verse. Shishya means instruct. So previously, in the earlier chapter of Bhagavad Gita and the whole rest of Mahabharata, there's a relationship between Krishna and Arjuna where they're the best of friends. Dearmost friends. At this particular juncture, Arjuna is requesting Krishna to consider himself in a different way, because Arjuna is considering himself in a different way. Rather than just, let's be friends, I would like that you instruct me. I'll take the position of your shishya, you're instructed, and you take the position of giving instruction. And by your taking the position of giving instruction, please clear my doubt. Please clear my weakness. Please clear my uncertainty. So I can know clearly what is best for me to do. So when that little section of faith, sometimes people know what the best thing to do is, And they hesitate. They don't do it because faith isn't so strong. Earlier in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna had spoken about Arjuna in a similar way. Asat Trishna. There is one of the coverings of the soul is thirst for the impermanent, hankering for impermanent things. And that causes the soul to be covered and not be able to discriminate in a determined way what should be done, what shouldn't be done. Then there's another that Krishna speaks of in the earlier chapter. That's Hridaya Dorbalyam. Sometimes people know what is to be done, and they hesitate. Their faith is weak. So one is you don't know, one is you know you don't do. So different kinds of or degrees of faithlessness. And the position that Arjuna is taking is, I have Krishna, I don't have faith in my own discriminatory power, but I have faith in you. So if you just instruct me, I'm ready. And at the very last thing that Krishna says to Arjuna, at the end of all of his instruction, is, now that you've heard, you consider carefully and do what you feel you must do. That's a relationship of faith, not a relationship of control. Where, okay, now you understand, Arjuna, that I'm up here and you're down here, so you better do it. That's not what Krishna says. It's not the position of a relationship with one who's very qualified. One who's very qualified, consider carefully, then act. Do what you feel you must do. Because that was the question that Arjuna presented at the beginning. What should one do? What should I do? What is my duty? Faith should be reposed. Go back to the divisions of faith chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Faith is natural, it's of the soul. So, according to the modes of nature, mode of goodness, mode of passion, mode of ignorance, they influence that which is of natural for the soul. And according to those modes of nature, then we exhibit faith. But if one hears Bhagavad Gita very carefully from Krishna, reads the message very carefully from Krishna, and moreover guided by one who is guiding on behalf of Krishna, then one can go beyond that faith that's born of the modes of material nature, where you're just being pushed or pulled by the movements of the modes of nature. That's Krishna's indication in Bhagavad Gita. That's what Krishna wants for Arjuna. He doesn't just want him to do what he wants him to do, meaning a certain behavior. What he wants is that Arjuna goes beyond the modes of nature and acts according to the indication of the soul's relationship with the Supreme Soul. That's what Krishna wants. And that's what, as souls, what innately, in our original condition, what we want. But one, go back to that the verse of chapter 9, those that are not faithful won't get it. It'll slip right through their fingers. In the introduction to Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada begins by offering an explanation why he's adding another translation of Bhagavad Gita. Because one American lady approached Prabhupada and asked, can you recommend a translation of Bhagavad Gita for me to read? And his answer was, no, honestly, I can't. There are over 100 of them, but I can't recommend one of them because they're produced from scholarship and not from realization. Because when they're produced from realization, then they're very powerfully effective. And when they're produced from scholarship, it may be interesting, it may change the configuration of your mind or your intellectual thought, but that neither of those are sustainable. It's not who we really are either, who we really are as spirit soul. So if the presentation of Bhagavad Gita is heard very carefully, very attentively, Krishna is speaking to me, or we can think like to each one of us, Krishna is speaking to kindly reach my soul and take my soul to the position of being with Krishna again. Just like Narada was saying from his previous life, from the association of these saintly persons, the desire awakened in him, even though he was very little, I want to meet my Lord. I want to be with him. I want to serve him. I want to be in that situation. And it was very genuine, very sincere, and it carried him to that position through association. So, back to the theme topic, how can we enhance our faith and attachment to Krishna through the hearing and chanting process? So much of it depends upon the association we keep and the qualitative way which we take up that association. And then anyone, doesn't matter, you can put any covering on the soul that you like, and it doesn't matter. Ultimately, the spiritual well-being of the soul can be awakened by a good association. There isn't a preliminary qualification needed. That is to say, even an impious person can be made pious through contact with Krishna and Krishna's message and Krishna's holy name. Just like wet wood can be made dry by placing the wet wood next to fire. It won't become dry immediately, but place the wet wood next to fire, it becomes dry. And then when placed in the fire, it can ignite. It can happen, you place the wet wood directly into a nice big fire. It makes a lot of smoke until it gets dry. And then it can burn. But if you put a big piece of wet wood on top of a small fire, it's going to put the fire out. So, better to put the wet wood next to the fire. And after some time it becomes dry. And then you put it in the fire. And then it can ignite. So like that, if we come into the association of those who are in the fire of spiritual life, in the fire of Krishna consciousness, and take that association, then gradually, like wet wood, we can become dry wood, and then we can ignite by that very same process of hearing and chanting. So our founder, Acharya, Srila Prabhupada, was very interested in creating situations where people can hear. He went out of his way. He traveled around the world 11 times to get gatherings of people together where they could hear. And then those that could hear, the wet wood became dry wood, then he asked them to continue the fire and let the fire grow. Again, it was just before here. I was in Nashville, Tennessee, and the person in whose home I stayed was Itai Gorasundar, who's Dr. Ravi Singh, and he told me something I didn't know, that he was connected with our Washington D.C. temple when the very time that previously there was a center in downtown Washington, D.C., Q Street, downtown Washington, D.C., and the person that was running the center had this bright idea of getting a little property outside the city in Potomac. And previously, that the property that we now have was kind of like a day camp, you know, a place where kids could go and play, and there was some, you know, some land, and they can run, have games, and be safe off of the street, because it's kind of a very quiet, in fact, it's a posh residential neighborhood. And everybody thought, oh, this is terrible. We're away from where all the preaching is. So he described that he called up every Sunday to get people to come to this, you know, remote place in Potomac. And they had, you know, 5 families, 10 families. And it, you know, so many years had passed from that time. He recently with his family went and visited Potomac, and there's gobs and oodles of people all over the place. And why do people come? The formula is very simple. Life attracts life. Where there's life, life attracts life. So the life is the hearing and chanting. And so Prabhupada would recommend in all of our centers, they should be regular activities, not only of deity worship, but hearing and chanting, kirtan and class, morning and evening. And by continuing that practice, people will come, because life attracts life. And as a result, over time, life attracts more life attracts, we need a bigger place. So they have some property, now they have this nice problem of creating a bigger place, because it's too small. They started with the temple, and then they went, got a little, renovated something, became a cultural center in the temple, and now they need a bigger place. They're looking for an architect. Somebody wants to volunteer and do some nice devotional service. You can make a plan for a temple in Potomac so they can expand and just bring people together for the purpose of hearing the topics about Krishna. Hearing topics about Krishna. I think we need another chair. Next thing you know, you'll be asked to be her mother or something.
Well, hopefully, grandfather.
Okay. Okay. They want you to sit in the chair. They won't be happy unless you sit in the chair.
Well, I'm down here now.
Okay. I think that's good for a little break. So, I hope the topic that was to be addressed got addressed. And if there's any questions or comments, please present them. Oh.
Maharaj, Prabhupada has this phrase that religion without philosophy is sentimentalism, and philosophy without religion is mental speculation. But then he says later on, I think, that meant like ultimately, even like a philosophical speculator can reach the absolute truth. So I was just trying to understand how is it that it seems like they should both be together in that phrase, but then he's saying that you can reach through that ultimately. So I was trying to understand how.
Well, I can't quite understand how either, because I don't really think he says it.
Okay.
Did you hear the question? There's a phrase that he's heard Prabhupada used, which is philosophy without religion is mental speculation or dry speculation, and religion without philosophy is sentiment. So juxtapose that with another thing that he heard that Prabhupada said that I never heard that he said, which is that ultimately by philosophical speculation one can also achieve perfection. There's a verse in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna speaks something a little different than what you just said. Bahunam jamanam ante. The other verse? Gyanavan ma prapadyate. Vasudev sarvamiti samahatma sadurlabha. So by the process of gyan, or speculative knowledge, one may, of course one may not also, and that's more common, but one may come to the position of recognizing Vasudeva as everything, Krishna as everything. And then when getting that realization, such a person surrenders unto me. But such a great soul is very rare. So one may come to the position of understanding Vasudeva as everything. That is, I'm looking for that which is beyond the temporary. And I recognize beyond the temporary is a unlimited, beginningless, endless, dimensionless, universally present Brahman, Brahman realization. Amongst those who have that realization, some may recognize Krishna is the source of that. Very rare. If they recognize that Krishna is the source of that, which is the source of everything, everything rests on Brahman, Brahmanohi Pratishtaham, then they surrender to Krishna. But it's not that by, they can come to that conclusion by mental speculation alone, rather by an element or a portion of devotion along with that speculative effort becomes part of their resource. And that comes by the association of one who is a devotee when they get that. And otherwise they won't get that. And in that case, they won't come to the conclusion Vasudeva is everything. So the second part just needs a little editing and then it's easy. It's not that by mental speculation alone can one come to the conclusion that Krishna is everything and surrender to him. And proof of that is they don't. I mean, there's so many translations or so many interpretations that are impersonal in nature. Blatantly or just scratched below the surface, and it's impersonal by nature. So far more commonly, what Prabhupada said was that at the utmost, if you know that the upward trajectory of mental speculation at most can come to an impersonal conception. That's topmost. Generally doesn't get that high. But if topmost is by neti-neti, by not iti, not this, not this, not this, what is Brahman? It's not this, it's not this, it's not this. Well, what is it? It's not this, it's not this. A definition by negation. It's what this isn't. That's the best. Impersonal conception. And the impersonal conception, Krishna says, rests on the personal conception, which rests upon him. Although it's plainly stated in Bhagavad Gita, an impersonal scholar derives some other meaning. They twist it and get some other meaning. Yes.
Faith is there. The process is also quite convincing, and trying to follow the process also. But sometimes it happens that there is an intense attachment towards Krishna, and sometimes it is totally gone, even while following the process and having the faith also. So why does it happen, and what is to overcome this? Is there any?
Sure. To make you feel better, it's a classic. It's called, there's a name for it, Anishtita Bhakti. Nishta means steady. Anishtita means unsteady. Boop, 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 boop. Like a sine curve. You know, from math, sine curve. Unsteady. Standard. Classic. Don't worry about it. Continue with the process. Here's what happens. Through the process, one becomes cleansed. Purification. The covering of the soul is reduced, like a diamond covered by mud or something. Clean the diamond. The sparkling quality is within the diamond. Keep cleaning the diamond. Some sparkle comes through and then you turn it and then you just see mud. And you turn it and you see mud. Keep cleansing the diamond. The sparkling quality comes because it's already there. The process that you described or referred to, Cheto Darpana Marjanam, you know the meaning. The consciousness becomes cleansed by the process. To keep following the process and consciousness becomes cleansed. And as consciousness becomes more and more cleansed, then here's what happens to the sine curve. The down portion becomes less, and then you know the axis starts going, and the amplitudes and the ups and downs start to diminish. It starts to become steady. So just continue to follow the process. Abhyasa yoga yuktena. Continue to practice. Make sure that you're following the process properly, nicely, and stay with it. And the cleansing will take place.
So, Maharaj, about chanting, like we should not commit the 10 offenses that have been specified.
Very good.
And about deity worship, so there are many things to be taken care of. So yeah. We might commit certain offenses without knowing also. So, how will I know?
The question is what to do about that.
Yeah, as you said, that follow the process nicely.
So, most important of all is the chanting. And here's a teaching that comes from our acharyas. What you described in deity worship is called seva aparad, offenses in deity worship. Whatever unknowing offenses may be committed in seva aparad, it's cleansed by chanting. So it doesn't mean, oh, look it, I got a license, I can do all kinds of awful things. I just chant Hare Krishna and it's all clean. That's not what it means. You try to avoid, you try to know what to do and what's not to be done, and try your best, knowing that there's going to be some error, unintentional, and go on, and it's not that you have to put your deities in a box until you're a pure devotee. You'll go on with the worship and chant the holy name and hear the message and follow the process. Gradually those offenses will be reduced and your chanting will gradually awaken the pure consciousness of the soul. Because of the power of the chanting, the sound vibration of Krishna's holy name. That's what we're resting our faith, because that's our topic. We're resting our faith on that potency that will carry us. Krishna's mercy will be in our lives through that calling upon His holy name, taking shelter of His holy name, and that will lift us up to the position of purity, where devotion to Krishna is not, you know, the sine curve, but it's steady. Okay? And it gets better after that. From nishta comes ruchi and astakti and bhava and prema. So you stay with the process. Yes?
So there's times, many times, where I have this pa'o moment. So I fall into the mode of passion or ignorance and trying to get back to Krishna consciousness, trying to remember Krishna becomes more problematic at that time because then...
Sure.
So what can I do about either not falling into the mode of passion or ignorance, or when I am there to try and get back to remembering Krishna.
Okay. We'll do the second part first. Maybe we should do the first part first. We'll do the second part first. When a child is learning to walk and the child tumbles to the ground and starts going, ah, so what to do? Get back up and walk again. And then tumble again. So, because the walking capacity is innate, it will come out just by practice. So, succumbing to the lower modes of nature, that's there because we're in the material atmosphere. And we're conditioned to that material atmosphere, and we've hung out in the material atmosphere for so long, it's so familiar to us, it's just second nature. We just involve ourselves with material energy in absent-minded way. And when you realize that you were absent-minded, then you hit the reset button. Again, and as you said, it's not easy because you're covered, your modes of nature are acting, to think of Krishna. But you do it anyway. And you do it anyway on the strength of your faith, but also the strength that's come from nice practice. So our, go back to the first question, our preliminary faith, go from the stages of bhakti are preliminary faith, association of devotees, and devotional practice, bhajana kriya. So go back to the basics of devotional practice and strengthen the association of the saintly persons that are operating in your life. Go, just go back to basics and make those basics very strong. And that's the strength to protect one from succumbing to darkness. Ramchandra can tell you all about it. Let's see if there's someone else that has. Any other? Yes.
Say you had the wonderful fortune of associating with Srila Prabhupada.
Yeah.
Can you just share in one or two episodes that you might not be familiar with, instances where faith is,
waiting for that one. That's a nice melody. Okay. Episodes with Srila Prabhupada that brought out faith.
Just saying, any episode of
the anything. That's real broad. Well, one of my favorite experiences with Srila Prabhupada was guarding his quarters all night long and watching him doing his translation work all night long. So the situation was, Prabhupada came to visit New York And devotees from all over the United States came to New York. And we had a double brownstone house. And, you know, we if the fire department had come along when we were occupying with 20 times the number of persons that would have been safe, we would have had lots of fines. The place was packed. And Prabhupada stayed for a week. And on the ground floor, it was a walk-up, and then the ground floor. On one side was the temple room, the other side was Prabhupada's quarters. So I was the temple commander, which meant, you know, I had to make sure that everything that needed to get done got done. So one of the services was guarding Prabhupada's quarters, because we didn't want people barging in and disturbing. So the front door was locked. The side door, somebody had to guard. And then there was, out back, we had a little garden in the back. It was really small, but it was, you know, somebody, you know, thief or somebody could come and try to harm Prabhupada, so we had somebody guarding in the back. And it was 24 hours a day. So the way that it works is the temple commander gets people to do stuff, and he can't get people to do stuff, he has to do it himself. That's what the temple commander's job is. And everybody was very happy to guard that, you know, going in and out of Prabhupada's quarters and saying, sorry, you can't come in because, you know, you don't have a permission. And then the back was also nice because you could look in and see inside Prabhupada's room, his quarters and whatever he was doing. You couldn't hear, but you could see. And even at night, because the door to Prabhupada's quarters opens up into his room, somebody could put their sleeping bag on the floor and put their head next to the door and they could sleep. And no one could enter because they would bang them in the head if they tried to enter the room. But the back wasn't the same, so I took the night shift guarding Prabhupada's quarters. And I watched his evening habits, and at 9 o'clock, very, you know, you could set your watch by it, at 9 o'clock he would leave the back room, go to the front room and sit, play harmonium, and sing alone. Just sing bhajans for 15, 20 minutes, and then go to his bedroom. The light would go out. Prabhupada laid down, 9:30, 9:25, 9:30, and at 11:30, the light would go on. And he'd go to the bathroom, wash his face and mouth, and then come to his big desk with all these big Sanskrit books. You know, like, you know, that had, you know, then he'd run his finger across the pages. So it's just this little night light above the desk. Prabhupada put on his spectacles and would read the Sanskrit of the commentary of our acharyas and then his little dictaphone, and he was dictating his Bhaktivedanta purports from, you know, 11:45 in the morning until 4 in the morning. While we're... he's doing his translation work. Every night. Every night. Every night. Every night. Very regulated. He was sacrificing his sleep for us. He poured his heart in the solitude and peaceful mode of goodness hours of the early morning to give us the Bhaktivedanta purports. And then at 4 o'clock he would go take his bath and then sit in his room and chant japa, and then at 6 o'clock we'd go for a morning walk and come back and give the morning Bhagavatam class, then come to his room, take, you know, little bit breakfast, and then continue the rest of his morning schedule. But every night. At an age when people don't do that, at any age that people don't do that, where his health was, and I found out later how bad his health was. He had one kidney that didn't work at all, another kidney that worked half. And, you know, nothing... And that was the reason I found out later why he took massage, because his body had all these toxins in the body that wasn't being eliminated by the kidneys, and that was supposed to help by that massage process, because the body wasn't doing it properly. he was, body-wise, he was always in pain, but he never, I never knew that. And he never restricted his activity because of that. He just went on. And his meditation was, beyond his life, he would give us, and all, and, you know, anyone who didn't have his physical association, to give a boat to cross the ocean of material existence through the transcendental knowledge of the Srimad Bhagavatam. That made a big, 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 big impact on me. Because I, you know, what he did all day long was what 10 persons couldn't do. Here's another little example. When he came to New York, he spent time with the, what is now the BBT, but then it didn't have a separate corporation, was ISKCON Press. It was the publishing group of devotees that did the service of publishing his books. So one of the divisions was the Sanskrit department, and one of the persons in the head of the Sanskrit department was Pradyumna Prabhu. Prabhupada called him Panditji. And Panditji was true to the qualification that he was lazy intelligent. Prabhupada says, lazy intelligent, active intelligent, lazy foolish, active foolish. And he was lazy intelligent. Too lazy. Because he was way behind. He was practically half a year, three quarters of a year behind. Prabhupada was holding up translation work, waiting for synonyms. And he hadn't done them. And when that was reported to Prabhupada, he wasn't happy. I wasn't in the room when that transpired. I heard about it later. That night, Prabhupada spent the night doing all the synonyms. And one night, he did 6 to 8 months worth of work. Prabhupada was intense. I mean, you know, he was very capable of accomplishing many things in a short period of time. Here's another one, related. For training of devotees, Prabhupada had an idea that he would spend time in Los Angeles, where he was for a while calling that his world headquarters. Later it became his Western headquarters, and later it's just the L.A. Temple. But he spent a lot of time at the L.A. Temple. And he wanted the standards to be what he wanted them to be. You know, treasury standards, accounting, bookkeeping standards, deity worship standards, management standards, and so on, standards. So he personally trained Mother Shilavati as the head pujari in L.A. And then later, some deities were donated to be worshipped in the Dallas Temple, so he sent Mother Shilavati to the Dallas Temple to train them. Commonly, he would have them come to Dallas and learn, here's the standard. But because this was tall, large Radhakrishna deities, he sent her. And then after some time, Prabhupada went to Dallas to see how everything was going. And Shilavati told him that she was having difficulty completing the deity worship in the time allotted. For some reason, it was, you know, the time that was there in L.A. didn't work for some reason in Dallas. So Prabhupada explained that if deity worship doesn't mean you take a lot of time, and that's what makes it nice. Deity worship is you do it efficiently, and that makes it nice. You do it nice, but do it efficiently. Then he said, I'll show you. And those of you here who have done deity worship will know this when I say it. When you're dressing a new set of deities, it always takes longer because there's something particular about the deity and something, you know, where everything is and so on. So Prabhupada went on the altar and dressed the deities, and she wanted an extra 15 minutes beyond what was allotted, and he did it in 15 minutes less time than what was allotted. And then it reiterated, it's, you know, devotion isn't how long it takes, devotion is you do it nicely. and then, you know, let Krishna enjoy. So he was expert in so many things. Anything else? Okay, you're on.
I was wondering about the role of doubt in our process, because especially in the beginning, we have so many doubts, and then these doubts and misgivings are slowly erased, they're gone.
Good.
So I've also seen others, not from per se Krishna consciousness, where somehow this phrase doubting Thomas, for example. So somehow I was given the impression that one should never ever have a doubt.
No, that's wrong.
Okay.
I don't know where maybe your mind gave you that impression, but according to Kapila Dev, in his teachings to Devahuti, it's a sign of intelligence. And he makes a distinction. When doubting is, I wish to know, and I don't have convincing, compelling information, and so I still wish to know. That's the doubt. And having that is a sign of intelligence. Then Prabhupada explains that when the doubt is addressed and one still doubts, that's not a sign of intelligence. So, let's say practically speaking, in presenting to whoever, to somebody in the world, somebody in the world and you're presenting Krishna consciousness and they have a different opinion, that's fine. Different opinion. The light's on. They're thinking. They're intelligent. Then, through the course of dialogue, when the proper knowledge is presented in a very clear, systematic, thorough way, that's an opportunity for the doubt to be addressed and cleared. And that's a sign of intelligence. Let's just say. Someone who has purity that maybe we don't have, but when there's purity and the proper understanding is presented, the doubt is cleared. That's also a sign of intelligence. And one can ask questions intelligently, and one can ask questions foolishly also. Another Prabhupada story. One time in New York, 22nd Avenue, Prabhupada was asked, Swamiji, I heard that when one becomes a guru, he knows Krishna. And one who knows Krishna knows everything. So how many windows are there in the Empire State Building? And Prabhupada, without a blink, he said, how many drops of water are there in a mirage? The guy had whiplash. He didn't know how to respond to that. And then he explained, you know, the trivia question of details of the illusory energy is not what it means that one who knows Krishna becomes the knower of everything. Rather, they become the knower of what is the foundational truth of everything. What is sat and what is asat. And varieties of that which is sat, they also come to know by Krishna's mercy, because they know Krishna. By Krishna's mercy, they come to know the distinction between reality and illusion, not the varieties of illusion, of all its innuendos. Anything?
Just one doubt. I don't know if it's a foolish question or an intelligent question.
We'll let him in charge.
It may not be completely related to the topic as well, but I was looking at the pictures.
I'm really ready now for anything.
But I was looking at the pictures, and when Narad Muni left his body,
yeah,
and he got his spiritual body,
yeah,
he had the Veena with him,
yeah.
His spiritual body was.
That's an artist's conception.
Okay.
That's to help us get an idea. Okay. Not the Veena was part of his spiritual body.
Okay, because the question was more in terms of if you are doing some service, or if you are really into playing an instrument, or will your spiritual body, or when you take a spiritual body, will you continue to do that, or is there any relation that you carry on from this life?
The best answer that I can think of quickly is bhava remains, but detail may vary. The mood of love will endure, but the detail may vary. Here's one example of what I'm saying. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, we find that the associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu have their spiritual counterpart in Krishna's Leela. So the forms of the personalities in Krishna's Leela that have their forms in Lord Chaitanya's Leela, they're very different. But their mood of love is identical or consistent, exhibited appropriately through that form or that form. You had something, yes?
Krishna Maharaj, thanks a lot. So, my question is about developing faith. So, there are certain... So the scriptures are very wide. They cover a wide range of things like cosmology and even astronomy, so on and so forth. And some of those things are not practically relevant to me. It doesn't make a difference to me whether, for example, whether mountains could walk, or they used to have legs, or whether the sun is close to them. It doesn't really matter to me. So is it necessary for...
No.
No, the question is necessary for me? That was my question. The question is, should we actually spend our time even reading about that part of the scriptures, even if they're in Sutta? Is it necessary to read them at all?
Isn't it okay to read them? Should we spend time with that which we have less interest in?
Not necessarily less interest. I don't see any practical... how can we act upon that kind of information?
Okay, it's getting a little more focused, but I'm still not clear exactly what you want to know. Why is it there to begin with? If it's not relevant to you?
No, that's not the question. It might be useful for some people, for some other devotees.
Okay.
It might not be useful to me. Like, for example...
Well, then I think it's very natural that you'll pay more attention to those things that you find is practical and useful, and less attention to those things that are not, they're not at least apparently touching your life at this moment. And is that okay? Yeah, that's okay. Or are you going to be confined from going back to Godhead if you don't know about all those things too? No. But the Srimad Bhagavatam is very broad. The Vedic wisdom is very broad. And Srimad Bhagavatam is the essence of it. So it includes many topics. Now, how you may see it touches on your life or doesn't touch on your life, that's another thing. One of the things that's important in such descriptions is the acknowledgement that As Jiva Goswami puts it, God is possessed of inconceivable potencies. Achintya Shakti. And inconceivable potencies means inconceivable potencies. So the value of descriptions like little things you just mentioned, God has inconceivable potencies. So because I can't conceive of something doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't exist or can't exist because I can't conceive of it. It's just so far beyond my experience that I can't conceive of it. The value is God has inconceivable potencies. And they're manifest in diverse and inconceivable ways. So at least this much. How wonderful is my Krishna? I sometimes like looking at National Geographic just for that reason. You know, the underwater sea life and all those really amazing guys that live under the sea and look really weird. And, you know, different insects and, you know, they're real good at capturing, you know, anomalies and or unusual forms of life. And then I like to think about, so how wonderful is Krishna? Then I like to think about what kind of desires must have get that kind of a vibe. Oh boy. Better watch out. Like that. Yes.
Maharaj, before Prabhupada Prabhu came, I didn't know that Prabhupada's books were being edited, but sometimes I feel like, what is the need to edit his books?
Well, he addressed that. That was, you know, I had him, I purposely requested him to make that presentation twice, and I'm sure it was right at the front end of his presentation. Prabhupada, what to speak of Prabhupada? Even Ishwara Puri, the spiritual master of Lord Chaitanya, wanted someone to edit his books, his writing. And Prabhupada explains why. That the person who is the author will not necessarily see little detailed grammatical or, you know, technical mistakes, because they're the author, they've written it. And someone else, a third party, they're looking at it and they go, hey, look at that. So Prabhupada wanted it because, well, let's say, on the one hand, it's unimportant. If there's a mistake, technical, grammatical, something mistake, it doesn't take away from the essence of the message. He gives the example of grammatical pronunciation or correct Sanskrit pronunciation. So how many, in the cultures of the world, how many different ways do people say Krishna's name? There's some languages where the R is spoken like an L. In Oriental languages, Krishna. But Krishna knows, you know, because it's the devotion behind the expression that Krishna is receiving. So, from an absolute point of view, it's not necessary. From a point of view of those persons who are scholarly, you know, in the cover of Prabhupada's books, commonly he would get reviews by scholars, and, you know, that's all they're looking for, is the fastidiousness of infidelity of from the Sanskrit to the English. And are there grammatical mistakes and things like that? So the polish is very important so that those persons would receive the message properly. And so he wanted, besides himself, someone, a third party, to look at the writing and see, does it express what I wanted to express? Or there's other things. He would dictate the transcribers couldn't understand what he said, and they would transcribe something that he didn't say. So he wanted editors to go back and hear the transcriptions and see if they got it, or put something else. And that's some of the mistakes that were made that the Dravida describes. He wanted a team of trusted persons, not, you know, many, a small number of very trusted persons, to go through his writings and comb through for those little technical things. So that, well, for the scholarly people that would, you know, they're nitpickers, excuse me, you know, that's the merit, is, you know, it loses its merit for them if it doesn't have all technical things in place. And that it conveys what he wanted to convey. English was not his first language. Certainly had command of English language. But there are expressions that may have meant something to him that means something different to his present audience, and things like that. So it was trusted persons that he wanted them. He gave them that service to do. Jayadvaita Maharaj being one of them. Does that help? Okay. We're all set. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.